Hello and welcome to the Friday, April 26, 2024 edition of the Sands and its Storm Centers Stormcast. My name is Johannes Ulrich and today I'm recording from Jacksonville, Florida. Quick reminder day from Jesse that even on a honeypot, the firewall configuration matters. It's less a matter of blocking or allowing certain ports, but redirecting traffic to appropriate listeners. The honeypot we are using is taking a page here from Kauri, where you are using IP tables in order to redirect traffic to individual ports that we have things like Kauri and our web honeypot listening on. That way, if the firewall rules are not configured correctly, you may miss quite a bit of traffic, and that's what Jesse observed in his Azure cloud-based honeypot. Black X is a little bit older botnet, originally coming out in 2020. In March 2023, Sophos wrote about it, and it had a couple interesting properties. One was that it's one of those bots that actually propagates over USB sticks. So if you connect a USB stick to an infected system, it copies itself and then could potentially be launched on a new system as the USB stick is being moved. Now, as of late last year, this botnet was really sort of considered somewhat dead because it only communicated with one specific IP address as a command control server. Well, it turns out that Sequoia has taken over that IP address. It was hosted with GreenCloud, so they pretty much just set up an account with them and had themselves assign this IP address. And since September last year, they're using it as a sinkhole to basically learn more about this particular botnet. Sadly, it always happens that there are still thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of systems infected by this somewhat older worm. And Sequoia now also discovered a little weakness in the command and control protocol used by BlackX that theoretically allows Sequoia to uninstall this particular worm. That, of course, puts up a whole set of ethical questions. And Sequoia sort of has a interesting approach to a kind of deal with that. They're now offering national law enforcement agencies the ability to essentially launch these uninstall commands. We have seen this in a couple cases before here in the US, where the FBI got court orders that allowed them then to send these uninstall commands. Just I think it was earlier this year with some of the router malware where they actually performed such a takedown, not just on the command control server side, but also on the infected host side. We'll see what happens with this interesting approach to sort of reach out to basically individual countries' law enforcement agencies to deal with it in a legal manner, typically involving some kind of a court order. But of course, the exact procedures will vary widely depending on the country that is engaging here with Sequoia, if they actually do. And open source firewalls are not free of vulnerabilities either. There is an update for pfSense that fixes four different vulnerabilities. Three of them are cross-site scripting vulnerabilities. The fourth one is a local file include vulnerability. A little bit hard to tell from the description how exploitable they are, but definitely something that you do want to patch. And GitLab also released an update. This one fixes five different vulnerabilities. The one with the highest CVSS score, 8.5, is a path traversal attack, but apparently only leads to a denial of service. And the one bug that sounds kind of interesting, and that relates to Bitbucket. If you set up a connection between Bitbucket and your GitLab instance, it's possible an attacker who has one of your users' Bitbucket credentials could take over another user's GitLab account. So not exactly sure how this works, but well, OAuth sometimes works in mysterious ways. And well, we do have another SANS.edu student for our Friday podcast. Matthew L. Voorhees is joining me here. Matthew, could you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, Matthew Voorhees. I currently work at a company called Medtronic. We develop and market medical devices, regulated medical devices around the world. And we're one of the larger players in the industry. The group I work in is a bit unique from traditional enterprise IT security. The group I work in is regulated medical device and regulated medical device software security. So we typically deal with non-traditional computing systems and software and how to secure those while also providing kind of therapeutic benefit within the expectations of customers, which are kind of hospitals and clinics, as well as regulators like the United States FDA that authorizes many of our products to be sold on the market. So that's Medtronic, and the group I work in. I've been part of the topic of regulated medical device cybersecurity for almost 8 years now, and it's kind of been a relatively new topic in our industry that really started around 2015 timeframe. But the focus of my kind of research paper that we'll chat about here is really on kind of preventative controls, because that is a larger focus for regulated medical device security, maybe more so than other computers that are more general purpose that are within the general IT enterprise. So that's kind of what I dived into, because that's what we're kind of restricted to work with in most medical devices that aren't connected to a network or the internet.
And that's sort of really the interesting part of the paper. I think I had at least one student on the podcast that talked about detecting living off the land attacks. And that's how it's usually being approached, kind of as something that's inevitable. You know, command.exe, ping, they are on the system. Hard to remove them. Maybe ping you could theoretically remove. I'm not sure what they would break. Yeah. Something would probably break if you remove ping. So you really more look for, is it abused? Is it used in any odd ways? But you actually try to look at how can you block usage. So can you talk a little bit about the approaches that you tried there? What worked, what didn't work?
Yeah, as I was trying to think of a topic for research, it was around the time that Vault Typhoon report was issued by kind of the Five Eyes and governmental agencies, as well as Microsoft. And one kind of keystone in that report was this idea of living off the land binaries. And this topic had been around for a number of years in our industry, but this was one of the first kind of big reports of it being used as a principal kind of tactic by threat actors to great success, right? So I think it kind of renewed interest in the topic, but also if you look at that report, they're not doing like complex things. They're not using like lull bins, as they're called, that are unknown or obscure, right? It's kind of traditional ones, right? Which is just kind of blows my mind a bit in the year 2023, 2024, right? When this research was done. So I think it also allowed me to take a step back and think that when we were back doing prevention of lull bins years back, we didn't have the prevalence of software as a solution technology. And over the years, over the last kind of 4 or 5 years, there's been a growing theme of the web browser as the new operating system, because frankly, a lot of kind of just general workaday activities for just a usual enterprise employee are really done within the web browser or basically the Microsoft suite of applications for Office. And kind of the combination of that kind of relatively new paradigm of lack of thick client applications for most workaday usage by enterprise groups, as well in combination with kind of lull bins being used by threat actors, but not really obscure log bins, led me to kind of the point of this research that I did, which was understanding if we could create some profiles of traditional enterprise users based on kind of their work tasks that they need to get done. And then actually testing, like, hey, is it actually possible to disable some of these traditional old bins like WMIC or even Ping, and still having these kind of workaday applications on the thick client side, as well as operations in the web browser, really not be impaired, right? And I think the new technology that we've kind of had opened up to us through certain vendors, including Microsoft, allows execution of those old bins for specific applications, right, that we trust. And if we can set established baselines of trusted applications in the beginning, the friction that's created from disallowing usage of those old bins outside of those trusted applications really goes down, right? And I think the research that I have in my paper kind of at least proves that out in some application, right? In kind of initial tests that were done and generic user profiles that were created for technical users that use a lot of thick client applications for like code development, but also for general general enterprise users as well.
How do custom sort of fat clients fit in there? Like, not familiar sort of with the medical device stuff, but I've seen sort of in insurances where you have these weird like wrappers around Telnet to connect to a mainframe or something like that. Would they sort of fit into that model?
So as I kind of thought about this, and this is a little bit in my paper too, but not as acute or apparent, I would say, is if you look at your just whole group of employees, and we're just focused on workstations for this research as well. We didn't really look at servers. But if you look at your full population of employees, there's a very small percentage of those employees that probably use PowerShell. And there's a very small percentage that probably use command line, right? Like, most people don't need access to those utilities for their day job. They need email, they need Teams, they need Zoom. Like, they don't need a lot of things. So you can really kind of isolate your risk for those unique employees that you mentioned that might need that middleware stuff that maybe is running on their computer, or even like a server that might need middleware stuff to operate. Like, if you can burn down the risk of allowing 100% of your employees access to all these utilities that they're never going to use, down to maybe 10% of the employees that might need them once a year, right? Like, that burns down a lot of risk very quickly, especially if you adopt kind of the allow list and deny list approach that recommended in my research paper, to make sure that work can still be executed, but you're shrinking down the attack surface of what malicious programs and threat actors can execute on a workstation significantly, right? And it's a defense in depth approach that you're not gonna remove all risk, right? You're definitely gonna prevent the execution of workaday kind of malware and malicious programs through what you're able to do through hardening of allow listing and deny listing application control approaches. But that still, at the end of the day, saves a lot of time and energy for incident response and working incidents, because you don't want them to be spending their time on old bins, right? You want them to be spending their time on more value add activities. And really, this helps at the end of the day reduce that noise that's created in the enterprise for detection of a lot of this stuff, and really focuses the time and energy of those responders on things that truly do matter, right? That are worth their time and investment.
Yeah, so an attacker gaining access to a machine and attempting to execute one of those blocked lulbins, would they still trigger an alert, or would they just not be able to execute it?
Yep, so So we're strictly kind of talking about Windows right now in the research I did, but I mean, it still gets logged in Windows logs, which would go to a SIEM or some kind of monitoring solution, right? Where it would block it, but it would also note that it blocked it and what it blocked and kind of the parent-child relationship with what it blocked and when it blocked and works. Like, you get all that information still, which is valuable to be aware that something was blocked, because Susan, who's never opened up cmd.exe in the 15 years she's worked at the company, just executed WMIC from a command prompt like that. That's never happened in almost 2 decades. And you want that's an anomalous behavior you might want to look into, even if it prevented the initial approach for the threat actor, right? So there is still value in detection and response, but it's more focused then, right? Like, you know that you've probably dodged the first bullet, but that doesn't mean you don't want to investigate and make sure that they don't try something different or don't enumerate your deny list to find ones.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. You want to know that they enumerate the deny list, so hopefully you'll stop them before they found something that you forgot, that you still had to have enabled. Have you attempted, aside from the research paper, to implement that at your organization yet?
In the context of regulated medical devices, it's a very difficult problem because they're providing therapeutic benefit, and we can't really use availability. Denial of availability is a control. Because that's a safety risk. So we have to get creative, right? But the silver lining is that we are not building general purpose computers. We are building computers that are designed to do a couple things very well in a very predictable way. And like, you can carve around capabilities of a computer to do a few things very well, very predictably. Through approaches like application control and allow lists and deny lists to very tuned degree nowadays. So we certainly do kind of apply that approach and principles to most of our medical devices that are not embedded systems, right? That aren't running on real-time operating systems or really thin pieces of footprint firmware, right? The bigger iron devices we like to think about that have a large footprint physically generally are running on Windows or Linux or kind of a combination of both if it has few computers. So that's definitely kind of a tried and true approach that we're able to leverage within medical device security for certain medical devices. Now, within the IT security enterprise we have here, I'm less involved with that side of the operations, right? So I'm not as familiar with their application control approaches that they've implemented through their tool suite. But from a regulated medical device side, certainly an approach we implement.
And I would think that, and you mentioned availability, that one of the selling points could be that systems more stable if you remove some of the unnecessary junk from it.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, it goes back to kind of basic cybersecurity principles, right? If you're never going to use it or need it, it's attack surface that can be leveraged. So the best kind of control response is removal, right? So there's a lot of effort done at the beginning of a project that leverages commercial operating systems to remove that attack surface and really truly harden the image of the operating system just down to what you need. A little more expansive, like, we have to do software bill of materials for our medical devices and software now, right? So if you're listing out all of the components in your software bill of materials, that is also a good gut check to say, like, I actually don't need all that stuff because we don't leverage any of those libraries or any of those utilities. Like, it's a good validation of like going down literally the list and saying, is this important? Is this really important? It isn't important. We never use it. Get rid of it, actually. So that is also a good gut check for us in this realm of application control and hardening.
Yeah. Thank you for joining me here. And, Where are you in your program? Are you done now or still have a class left?
It is really funny, actually. I'm in my last class and I submitted my last assignment, but it hasn't been graded yet. So I have no more work to do, but I'm technically not complete. I'm in the purgatory realm right now, but I really appreciate the opportunity and frankly, the support from the SANS Institute to really do my first kind of academic research and spread my wings a little bit.
Yeah, thanks. And I have to check my inbox if your paper is waiting there for a grade.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. And thanks everybody for listening, and talk to you again on Monday. Bye.